Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast, chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to writer D.M. Shepherd about her horror novella, The Darkland. Over the course of the interview, I chat to her about the inspiration behind the story, her research into Athabascan mythology for the novella, and how she was careful to avoid the stereotypical strong female lead when it came to her central character of Rose. Elsewhere in the interview, we talked to her about how she developed an interest in monsters, myths, and legends from a very young age, as well as giving us an insight into her somewhat isolated writing process from her remote cabin in Chicken, Alaska, which is very interesting indeed. Before we get to all that though, I'd just like to quickly remind you the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and Stitcher. Anyway, now on to the interview with Daniela. Hi Daniela, welcome to New Horror Express.
Thank you. Thanks for having me as a guest.
It's no problem, no problem at all. So we have you on a guest today to talk about your novella, The Darkland. So for the listeners, give us a quick synopsis of what The Darkland is about.
The Darkland is based on Athabasca legend of the people with tails. It's set in Wrangell St. Elias National Park, Alaska, and involves two people searching for the remains of a missing person, only to find that they are being stalked by said mythical creatures.
So how did you first come about this Alaskan lore about the people with tails? And what made you think, I could write something about this?
Well, it actually came about because my husband moved to Alaska 30 years ago and homesteaded out in the interior in part of this region where the book is set. And he used to do a lot of climbing and hiking out in Wrangell St. Elias National Park. And he also did a lot of reading about the region. And he had kind of a spooky encounter in the woods one day, actually in a place called Bathlonetas, and I might be mispronouncing that slightly, but it's an Otno word, which is one of the Athabascan tribes for roasted salmon place. He went into Wrangell St. Elias, said, I want to go hiking here. And the guide at the visitor center is like, you don't really want to go there. That's kind of a sketchy place. And he's like, looks like a cool place on the map. And so he went walking out in the woods. Summer day, really nice. And he said he got about a mile and a half from the trailhead, just got a really bad feeling, and he turned around and ran all the way back to the trailhead. And when we talked about it, he said that it's just the woods got incredibly silent and he got the feeling something was there, so he ran. Now, when you start looking into the mythos about that particular area, there is a legend, it's part of the oral tradition of the Otna tribes, from a book called the Upper Tanana and Otna. The book is called The Headwaters People. And so all of their legends are oral tradition, but there's a specific story about that area, about the ones called People with Tails, or the Katene. And the Katene used to sit and watch from the hills above, and they were the enemies of the Otna people. And they would come down and kidnap people from the village, kill them, do all kinds of things. The story, the legend is a very long story or a song. And eventually the Otna fought them and wiped them out. So that's where like the initial idea for the story came from. But the more I dug into it, there's other peoples in that region that have different iterations of that same legend. So if, for example, in Canada, the Dene people have an area called the Headless Valley, where there's over history have seen people go missing and their bodies turn up headless and no one can explain it. So this kind of all wrapped into the mythos behind my story, the Darkland.
And so was that the Canadian tribe, that mythos, is that where you brought the headless ravine from your story?
The idea of the headless ravine is partly that story, but also in the legend of the Katene, they would, it specifically talks about how a young man from the tribe went missing. And when people went to search for him, they found the tailed ones, the Katene, playing almost like a game of soccer with his head.
And in terms of, like, so was the research that you did for this quite deep? How much of the story is directly taken from these legends? How much is your invention or your embellishments?
You know, a lot of it is more my own embellishment, because obviously this is set in modern times. It's actually set in a different part of the park, a different region, at least this initial story. So when you look at how big Alaska is, this particular, the Atna are what they call, like I said, the upper headwater people of the Copper River. So they're probably about 70 to 90 miles away from where I actually set this particular part of the story, though they're still in Wrangell St. Elias National Park, and they're still in the same mountain system. Then meanwhile, you know, the Dene and the Han people who have similar stories, they're hundreds of miles away. So there's just little bits and fragments that I've taken, but I had to kind of use the environment in which I set the story and the modern times to kind of create my own mythos of how the creatures acted, what they looked like. There's not much of a description really of what the people looked like, except they were hairy, they looked kind of like people, and they had tails. So I kind of created what I thought a creepy creature that looked like a person and had tails would look like. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it seems like you went to quite an effort to make it feel and seem authentic, though. It's not just like a horror that's like flippant in terms, you know, there's, for example, of horror movies, it's like, this house was built on an ancient Native American burial ground. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, but what I also looked into, part of my research was not just the Native legends. So I mentioned my husband's lived here in Alaska a long time. One of his backgrounds is geology. And so the reality, though those particular tribes may not have had direct contact with each other, well, how could these creatures move throughout the park and be on both sides of the mountain? Because my sequel to the story, which I'm currently writing, is set in what we call Copper Lake, which is where the Atna are, the Atna tribes lived. So the Wrangell St. Elias system is, you know, it's volcanoes. In particular, Mount Sanford is a shield dome volcano with an extensive lava tube system that runs underneath. So I did a lot of research into that to kind of help connect the two stories of, like, well, how could these creatures move so freely and have different tribes have different related stories in between?
And how quickly did the novella come together? Like, was it one of those processes that was just kind of, I mean, obviously you did a lot of research, but like once you started to get down to write the Darklands, was it kind of come out in a flood, or was it bitty piecey, or how difficult or easy was the process of the writing process?
Well, you know, it was funny because it started out, you know, I'm hearing, you know, I heard my husband's story first and thought, oh, that's really kind of neat. And so then I read the stories in the Headwaters People book, and I was like, wow, that's, you know, that's a pretty that's a pretty intense story as well. Read the stuff about the Headless Valley. So all this stuff got me thinking, it's like, oh, wouldn't this make a really cool short story? It all started out as actually just a short story. And then after I wrote the short story, it became something a little bit longer and a little bit longer. And before I knew it, I'd written a novella. And so that's actually really how it developed. And I wrote it pretty quick. I wrote it out at my cabin. And I think I've mentioned I have a cabin in Chicken, Alaska. And so that's where we go to kind of get away from everything. And so when I'm out there, I don't have a lot of distractions. So I wrote this over the course of a couple of weekends out at the cabin. Now, the editing took a lot longer, but pulling the story together was pretty fast.
And in terms of there's kind of two main central characters, Rose and Ulrich. Were there any inspirations for those characters? Like, did you take anything from people that you know, or just entirely your own invention?
I would say the characters, some of them, I guess, some of my friends who kind of helped beta read my stories, you could say they're almost kind of like a Frankenstein of people that I know, that I've worked with over time. I would say that Ulrich is kind of my own invention, as is Rose, but like the just little bits and pieces of people I know. Actually, more some of the secondary characters are probably closer to real people I know than the main characters, I would say. In fact, I would joke that there's a scene in there with the Edna, the caretaker of the lodge, who she stubs out her cigarette on the monster's forehead. And my husband's like, wow, we could totally see our friend Barbara doing that. Our friend Barbara is Alaska Native, and she's a smoker, and she just she's got a pretty funny sense of humor, very blunt and direct, and that's how she would act against one of those creatures, just stub out her cigarette on his forehead.
I did find that scene quite funny. That was one of the moments I laughed. It was, entertaining.
Now, the scene that my husband still like picks on me about is at the end. Like, he keeps asking, did you have to hack up the husband with an axe? It's like, well, duh, yeah, it's not you.
Yeah, fair enough.
he seems rather upset by that. I don't know why.
Who knows? I was wondering as well, like with the central character of Rose, were you conscious of avoiding certain cliches in terms of, a lot of female characters are often either meek or they're the kind of stereotypical strong female character. Now, Rose is obviously a strong female character, but is also has a vulnerability to her and feels like a human character and not just an archetypal badass female.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That's great feedback. One of the reasons I started writing, I do read a lot and I do a lot of book reviews, is I get very frustrated by what I see in literature is, I call it the rise of the quote unquote stereotype female badass. That, she can outdo, outdrink, out anything, anyone. And it's like, well, that's not realistic. We all, everyone's different, but it just seems like there's this rise in writing nowadays of making this like perfect badass female. And it's like, you can have a strong woman that is multifaceted and dimensional. And I think we're starting to lose that in this pursuit of, it's like you've heard of the trope, the Mary Sue.
Yes.
So this is, I feel like this is almost becoming the new Mary Sue in literature.
Yeah.
The badass.
Yeah. I can get that. I think probably for so long that female characters were in the other direction, there's maybe as a kind of direct polar reaction to that. And now they're making everybody like Sarah Connor and Terminator 2 kind of thing.
Yeah, but at least with Sarah Connor, there was definitely like a you know, a character arc between the movies. You know, no, she starts absolutely. Out. I think actually one of my favorite strong females was Ripley in the Alien movies.
Yeah, I mean that's a great character in terms of like the female badasses who are also have like a proper character arc and you know aren't just a total badass to start with, like you know you see the genuine arc there from the first film of like she is you know vulnerable and then you know but over the course becomes more and more hardened.
But it's also one I feel that, you know, to be the quote unquote badass doesn't mean you have to be hard.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. You know, yeah, I mean, it's, you need nuance, you know, it's like you said, there's, you know, we're all human, you know, even these characters, and there's not just going to be like one thing, you're not just going to be badass 100% of the time always,
right?
But anyway, but you are very conscious of that cliche. That's
thanks, I really appreciate that feedback.
So why did you decide to get into this story of like what I mean, or the other, I've noticed from your website some of the other ones that you've written are kind of more romantic thrillers, stuff like that. Why did you decide to take the leap into horror?
Well, actually, as I may have mentioned, I've mentioned in a couple of blog posts, I've always had an interest in horror. And, you know, some of my romantic suspense novels that I've written, though they're romantic suspense, they're on the borderline of being pretty dark. When I send them out to my beta readers, the comments I've gotten back, especially about like one story in particular that I wrote, Torched, the people have said, wow, this is a great story, but the beginning is really bleeped up. I really liked this story, one, because it's a part of Alaska that I really enjoy going to. I love the legend behind it. And it's just one, I guess, that I also felt that in terms of just taking the leap of writing it and self-publishing it, a lot of publishers aren't really interested in a novella. They, you know, they want a full-length novel. And I thought this would be a great way to test the waters. I've always had an interest in horror. Where I grew up, even though I live in Alaska now and I have for 13 years, I grew up in a small town in the Mojave Desert named Victorville. One of the movies that, you know, was filmed out there actually the year before I was born was The Hills Have Eyes, 1977. And so that was, you know, it's a horror classic and great flick. And then there have been other countless movies that have been filmed out there even since the 1950s, like the And It Came From Outer Space, more sci-fi than horror. The Quentin Tarantino movie From Dusk Till Dawn was filmed in Victorville. If you like Bruce Campbell versus the Army of Darkness, it's funny how they thought they could make the Mojave Desert look like England. That was filmed not quite in Victorville, but in the mountains just outside of Palmdale. But yeah, there were so many horror movies filmed in my hometown. And there was a group of friends of mine, my friend Kevin and my friend Phil. We would get together and watch some of those movies and just geek out over them. So that's why I think horror was just kind of a natural fit. I grew up reading a lot of horror, well, sneaking it from the library, because I don't think my mom would have been like too cool to know that I was, some of the things I was reading from about the time I was like 10, 11, reading Stephen King instead of Sweet Valley High, even though that's what I was pretending I was reading.
So is King like one of your earliest horror inspirations? And in terms of like, when writing your own novella, was there any particular writers that inspired you?
You know, I would definitely have to say, yeah, Stephen King is probably one of my earliest inspirations. But aside from that, probably just more doing my own thing. I always kind of feel a little funny when people are like, oh, I want to compare myself to some other author. It's like, well, I'm just me. You know, there's, I just want to write how I write. One of my other novels I'm working on, my other series, if you checked it out on my website, my Drink of Darkness series set in Dawson. I'm really trying to push that one. That one's like borderline paranormal horror, and it's pretty dark. And I've sent it off to a few editors, and already I'm getting the, you know, we don't know if we can publish this. Because people might push back on it. And it's like, well, then I'll probably just self-publish it.
What is the kind of elements that feel, or they feel people would push back on?
You know, they feel that they, at least what it's almost, there's parts of it that are, in this case, that series is almost a cross between Anne Rice and Stephen King. And so they worry about the kind of dark erotic elements are what they worry people would push back on. In that story, I've written about female vampires who are coming to Dawson. In 1898 was the peak of the gold rush in Dawson City for the Klondike. When the Canadian Mounties did their census that year, 40,000 people went through in the summer, but only about 16,000 stayed to winter over. And of that 16,000, only about 500 were women. And of those 500, most were ladies of the night. So in my story, there's a trio of vampires that comes to town to mine the miners for more than gold. But they've brought with them a kind of feral young vampire that they turned, not knowing she was crazy because of the sexual abuse she's been through. And I've kind of, in that book, exploring some of the exploitation that happens amongst sex workers. That's from not only research from our own time, but research I've done back then using a couple of books from the Klondike Gold Rush. Now, what ends up happening with this young feral vampire is, imagine a kind of crazy vampire with unlimited power and who isn't quite all there upstairs getting turned loose on a town like that.
Certainly sounds interesting. I'd read it.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, it's funny because I post on Twitter and on Facebook, I post snippets of my little vampire. Her character name is Liz, by the way. And so, like I said, she has no impulse control. She's been, trained to play with her food. So she's very easily triggered. And there's a lot of people that are like, wow, she's really creepy. But at the same time, I'm kind of rooting for her. And so, yeah, she's just loose in this town of, you know, 16,000 men in the dark in winter where there's no escape, there's nowhere to go. And so she's just kind of tearing up the town and slowly figuring out what she is because she doesn't know what she is.
I feel it shares certain themes with the Darkland as well, because like the Darkland also explores it, abuse, violent abuse, sexual abuse. Is that something that's a kind of topic you feel drawn to write about?
Yes, I do. And to be honest, there are links between the mythology in the Darkland and the mythology, you know, the vampires and the tailed ones in the Drink of Darkness series.
Because I was also thinking, because in the Darkland, even though there's a lot of horror scenes in it, one of the most harrowing sequences in the novel is a description of sexual abuse. How careful are you when you write something like that? How conscious are you of it not feeling exploitative? And how difficult is it to write something like that, a passage like that?
Well, let's see. I guess it's one that when I wrote it, to be perfectly frank, I based it on my own experiences when I was young. So granted, what I went through was nowhere near that graphic, but I did it because I feel that a lot of what we see nowadays is washed down and watered down, and I wanted people to understand what it's like for the victim. A lot of times the victims are told to be ashamed of it or water it down, and so I wanted people to understand how horrific it could be from the perspective of the victim.
And I mean, like I say, amongst all the horror, it's a kind of standout traumatic, harrowing scene in the novella. So it very much comes off the page in those terms.
And it was also one of those things that when people read it, you know, I did kind of want people to think about it's, you know, it's almost a duality. It's like you have the horror of the mythical creatures, but you have the horror of real life events. And what is more horrific for Rose? What she's going through when she's facing these evil creatures, or what's more horrific, what she went through in her past?
So you think by writing about it in the terms that you write about it, that it can open doors in terms of it being not hidden, and you know, that terrible abuse, a lot of terrible abuse happens in the world, and creating that discussion of not watering it down. You feel that's a kind of cathartic thing?
Well, it's, you know, I think everyone will take from it what it means to them, right? And, you know, for some people, like when you think about people who've been abused or had things happen to them, some people, it's not cathartic for them to hear about it. It's not cathartic to talk about it. But others, it might be. For others who've never experienced it, it might be eye-opening for them. Now, for some people, they'll push back and be like, this is overblown, this is not realistic. So it's, I think everyone will take what they want from it, but it's just more me putting it out there.
In terms of the, like, going back to the more mythical horror elements, the novel, I was intrigued by the changes in tone that they sometimes had. Of, I think at the start of the novel, there was, I had an idea of what the type of horror it would be, a kind of creeping horror, the, you know, a kind of unnerving type of horror of eyes in the woods. But there is, later on, there is elements of like a kind of broader horror that was surprising. You know, there's, I think I counted at least 3 or 4 head explosions, which I didn't necessarily expect at the start of the novella. did you deliberately have that as kind of like, this is going to surprise people?
Actually, you know, that I didn't even think of it that way. That's that's kind of funny to get that kind of outside, that outside opinion, because, you know, I had thought of it as kind of a creeping thing through the woods. But then it's like, I don't know, how do we respond to things here? It's like, okay, you know, we're gonna shoot it. I don't know.
I have to say, talking about outside perspectives, and this is purely because I live in Scotland, and there is really, outside of like farmers and the odd hunter, there's really not a lot of guns here. So the fact that like everybody in the novel has guns, and I understand that probably in reality of your reality there, I presume that because it's Alaska and there's all sorts of dangerous things, probably everybody does have guns. But that was a kind of weird thing for me. I was like, everybody just has guns. This is
well, I would say definitely like out in the interior, like where we are, like where our cabin is, especially, or we are always carrying, because like, for example, at our cabin, we have 31 acres surrounded by just sheer wilderness. We've had, you know, grizzly bears and moose come within a couple hundred yards of the cabin. And so we carry rifles. We carry a .44 on the property, because at any time we could encounter bear. The same with, you know, if we're out camping, like when we go to, particularly some of our friends, we go down to visit them on the Kasilof River. There's a lot of bears down on the Kasilof. Now, during when it's fishing season, the bears are really more interested in the fish than they are you. So as long as you stay out of their way, they don't care. But you can get aggressive ones, especially if you get between a female and her cubs. So yeah, a lot of people here are carrying weapons. But here, mostly, I would argue, mostly for bears. I carry, like, you know, you hear it referred to a .44. When I go hiking, I carry a titanium .44 for bears. And, you know, I dread ever having to use it on a bear, because it's a pretty powerful weapon. And there's no guarantee it would actually stop a bear. It might actually make it angrier. but that's about the most powerful thing I can lightly pack when I hike.
Is that not terrifying? I mean, I've never lived anywhere that has bears. Is it like, and so, yeah, what made you want to move from, I know you've probably been asked this question a million times, but move from California. I'm sure that, do they also have bears?
They have bears in California, but not really where I lived down in the desert. But I didn't directly move from California. I joined the Navy, and I lived a couple places in between. But after I got out of the Navy and I lived and worked in Seattle for a little while, I got a job offer that moved me up here to Alaska. And I love the outdoors up here. It's absolutely beautiful. Sure, it is unnerving because, but understanding the bears and just understanding that, yes, at any time you could encounter one, but taking preventative measures to not encounter one, and then we typically carry, like, so in my case, when I'm out, I'm carrying a weapon to defend myself, but I'm also carrying bear spray, doing things like making noise. Most bears don't want anything to do with you. They will avoid you if they can. So making a lot of noise so they hear you coming and they go the other way. Moose, on the other hand, moose are far more dangerous than bears. More people get killed by moose in Alaska than bears every year. And that's a statistic a lot of people don't really know. And we've got a lot of moose. So the moose scare me far more than the bears because they're not too bright. They're like, just picture like really, like picture cows that are really like vicious and like dangerous and bigger.
Yeah, sounds pretty dangerous. What is it that you really like about just, I mean, I read your blog and about your cabin in Chicken and how, according to the census, there's only like 5 people. And, apart from a couple other people there, who live semi nearby from your cabin, there's like nobody in like a 70 mile area, which is like, because Scotland's a small country, it's like one side, it's like going from the east coast to the west coast in Scotland, across country. So what is it that attracts you about that, Mike?
When I met my husband, he already owned the property. And so I kind of, he brought me along. Actually, it wasn't our first date, but we had been dating like about a month, and he invited me along on a camping trip out there. And, it's beautiful country that I just really enjoy getting out there and getting away from everything. When we're out there, we have literally no cell phone access, no AM/FM radio, no power, though we have a solar kit now, no running water. We're working on that probably next summer. We're going to put in our own cistern system. But yeah, it's very peaceful. We, this whole like hunker down thing, we kind of laugh when it's like, we go out there, there's nobody. We're not, worried about not talking about anyone. We just, it's nice to be away. And when I said I can write a lot, I can write so much because there's absolutely no interruptions other than like doing work out on the property. We have a lot of work that we do on a regular basis out there.
I mean, obviously you are in kind of complete isolation. So I imagine it must focus the mind quite a lot.
Oh yeah.
How did you first get into writing? Like, obviously you've had an interesting career. You've been in the Navy. You're an electrical engineer. And obviously it's not always associated, being the kind of left brain, right brain thing. Some people are creative, some people are sciencey, but often it's not the case that they're both.
I don't know. I have always liked to write. So even when I was a kid, I actually had a book published when I was like 7 through like Young Authors here in America. It's called There's a Dinosaur in My Classroom. And it was not anything really all that great. It was just like a little kid's book. But I always liked to write. I would write stories. I would tell stories. In fact, the Darkland was dedicated to my little brother because I would sit and tell him horror stories, and no matter how gruesome or gross they were, he'd always beg for more. And And I always like to read. I was actually in honors English, even though I was in honors physics and honors math growing up. I was also in honors English. And so it just came naturally to me. Now, when I was in the Navy and when I was in college, I wrote a lot of stories that I actually just threw away. I never thought of getting them published. They were just something I did for fun.
And at what point did you think, like, yeah, I want to put these out to the world? Like, it was more that this became more than just, like, I'm just writing these for my own entertainment and creative outlet.
You know, it was round about, 2014, 2015. At the time, I was working a rotational position, so two weeks here in Anchorage, 2 weeks up in Prudhoe Bay. And so going up there, I was reading a lot, but I was finding that, when I would go to the bookstores, trying to find new books, I wasn't finding a lot of stuff that I really like to read. I'd pick up a book and get all excited about it, get like 50 pages into it and be like, this is horrible. Like, I'm writing stuff that's better than this. Why, they say write what you want to read. And I was like, well, why don't I try? Why don't I at least try to get something published? And so that just kind of got me thinking. It's like, well, I should at least give it a shot, And the one thing that's been great about trying to get published is connecting with so many other indie authors who are writing really cool and unique things. I've gotten to read so many things that, that are just not something that the traditional publishing industry had published. Either they've published it themselves or they're going through a smaller publishing company. And I've just read so many fantastic things and I'm like, wow, this is great.
So did you try and get the Darkland published traditionally before you self-published, or were you always planning to self-publish that one?
Nope, I was always planning to self-publish that one. I decided that since, a lot of the traditional publishing houses just aren't interested in novellas. They want a full-length novel. And then on top of that, since I do have so many other novels that I'm either, I'm trying to figure out which way I want to go with them. I've been querying them. Not getting anywhere with my querying. But then it's like, okay, well, I decided to self-publish this one to see what it took to get something self-published, and then two, to kind of help build up myself as an author. While I've been active on social media and whatnot, I don't have a big fan base, right? Nobody knows who I am. So I thought, well, this will be a good way to put my writing out there and see what people really think of something that I've written beyond just a tweet or a little paragraph online.
You mentioned your beta readers a couple of times. In terms of like having those beta readers for the Darklands, did you change anything based on their feedback?
Oh, yes. And actually, I'm really like the beta readers I've gotten, and like I said, I mentioned a lot of those indie authors. Yeah, they were great in helping me refine the story because, like I said, especially kind of like what you mentioned is like living here in Alaska, there's some things that I just take for granted living here that people who don't live in Alaska are like, what are you talking about? And vice versa. There were a couple of scenes that there's one girl online that I've connected with, and she's, in my opinion, she's a great beta reader. She says she's not, but she is willing to give absolutely brutal but hilarious feedback. You read her feedback and she'll be like, Daniela, your character is acting like a dumbass here. You need to change this. And she's like, Daniela, this line totally doesn't make sense. What are you talking about? So she'll give you feedback. Like she doesn't pull any punches. And I appreciate that. I think some people are afraid to hear where the writing sucks. Not me. I'm like, please, I need to hear it. I need to hear it now because your reviewers online will not hold back.
Yeah, that is true. So you would rather just have like straightforward criticism rather than people like kind of pussyfooting around what they might feel is a flaw in your work?
Oh yeah, I am totally, people who want to tell me, like this, like she was just flat out in some places like, Daniela, I don't like this part. You know, your character is acting like an idiot. You need to fix this part. You know, but then other parts, she was like, this part is fantastic. I love this part. Like, hey, Daniela, this doesn't make any sense to me, or you're using this word too much. She gives very good feedback, as did a lot of my other beta readers. They were like, oh, I love this part. Some people are a little too hearts and flowers. They just want to tell you everything is great, which is nice. I mean, that's great when the product is finished and it's on the shelf. That's kind of where you want to hear everything is wonderful. But when you're first going through those first revisions, I want to hear where it's terrible. I want to hear where I need to fix it.
So was it more character motivations and certain lines and stuff like that that changed rather than anything to do with the kind of central narrative, the kind of backbone of the story?
Yeah, it was more character motivations. More than I needed to make certain character motivations clearer. There was actually one big one that, now that you mentioned, this was one my husband caught, just more of a continuity error, going back to weapons. And it's like, okay, at the very beginning of the book, when he takes a shot at the creature hiding in the dark, yeah. That was actually set in a different part of the cabin, and the scene played out differently the way I originally had it. And my husband was like, whoa, Daniela, you need to rethink of this. He's like, think about it. If you hit something with that big a caliber of a weapon, that's a lot of mess to clean up. You don't want it on the bed. Originally, I had it on the bed. He's like, there's no way they're going to sleep on that bed tonight. And I was like, oh yeah, I should probably fix that.
I have to say, not being a gun person, I probably wouldn't have even thought about it, but yes, that maybe makes sense.
but as my husband pointed out, anyone who knows anything about guns would totally call you on the carpet about it. But that's one that got past a lot of my beta readers who weren't that much into guns or weapons, but my husband is, and he's like, oh, you got to fix that one. And it's just like, and it was funny because I didn't even think about it, but as soon as he said it, I was like, oh no. So yeah, we had to rewrite that part.
I was wondering as well, you say in the acknowledgements, as well as your long love of horror, you've, as well as the tail people, you've long had an interest in all those kind of myths and legends around the Yeti, the Bigfoot, the Skinwalkers, the Yukon Man, all those kind of things. Like, what is it about those things that you're attracted to, that first captured your imagination?
Well, I think it just kind of goes back to where I grew up in California. We had the legends of the Yucca Man there in the Mojave Desert, and then the Skinwalkers are more towards the Navajo, towards the east of us. Either way, it's the idea that, we in our modern civilization, we think we're comfortable thinking that we know that we found everything that's out there, but yet could there be things out there in the dark that we don't know? And we're just making an assumption. And I think that's kind of a lot of classic horror, right? That thing in the dark that you assumed wasn't there, was just a bump in the night, turns out to be more. And in this case, and it's something I hope to explore as I write this, as I write the sequels to this novella, it's like, okay, well, when you get into like creatures like, say, for example, in Friday the 13th or Freddy Krueger, that are truly evil, right? But these are creatures that are in nature. So are they truly evil? Do they deserve to be wiped out just because they're not like us? It's, I've written them in this first novella. I mean, they're definitely antagonists to our characters and we don't like their motivations. But it's like, what is it, do they, I'm going to try and get into the legends behind them. My husband and I have been, doing a little bit of additional research and kind of some theories as to where these creatures could have originated from, or the legends behind what these creatures could be. There's been some like papers and stuff written about what they think these things came from. So it's like, well, do they deserve to be wiped out just because we don't like them? What is that, the nature of these things? If we did find out that there's some creepy, like yucca man, Bigfoot, something like that living in the woods, what would we do to it as humans? Would we wipe it out? Would we put it on show? That's, you know, kind of one of those things I wonder. Even though we write about it in horror and it's scary and it jumps out at us, it's kind of the horror within ourselves, right? Are we that altruistic or good?
So in the sequels, is that something you're going to delve into, the kind of the other side of it, the maybe some of the motivations or some of the instincts that drive the tailed people?
I'm hoping to, yeah. When I maybe not so much, maybe towards the end of the second book and going, I'm planning to do 3 books at least, depending on how it goes.
And are you planning to have Rose and Ulrich as the kind of protagonists throughout the trilogy? Are we going to continue to follow those their adventures? Are we assuming that the characters who appear in the epilogue are just wiped out?
So in second book, the characters that appear in the epilogue take over for most of the second book. Ulrich and Rose will join whoever survives at the end of the second book.
Oh, so we don't catch up with them for a while.
Yes, we won't catch up with them for a while. I'm giving them a break. They got pretty beat up.
I mean, they absolutely did. Not to give too many spoilers for the listeners, not read it yet, but yep, they do take a battering in the novel. And so how far through the second book are you?
So I've got the second book pretty well plotted out. I'm only about a quarter of the way writing it. I'm hoping to start sending it out to beta readers in June. Like mid to late June, getting it edited in July and August, and then hoping to get to self-publish it by October.
And do you have, like, even if you've not plotted it, do you have a kind of arc in your head of how you want the story to wrap up across a trilogy, or are you just working kind of one book at a time?
It's one of those things that in my head, I have an idea of how I want the arc to end up. However, I guess you could say I almost have more than one arc, so I'm going to kind of think about which one, as I finish writing the second book, I'm going to think about which one actually falls more in line with what I've written. And also, when I get my feedback from my beta readers and from readers who've read the first book, you know, like actual reviewers, that'll help kind of inform where the overall series goes.
And is that the only thing you're currently working on, or are you working on other novels, short stories, whatever, as well?
So right now, because I'm so involved in writing the sequel to The Dark Land, that's my main focus. I did write something that is completely not what I normally write. I wrote a contemporary happy ever after romance for an anthology for, you know, because everyone's under lockdown right now. A bunch of us writers got together and decided to do a free anthology that people can download with happy stories. So that's something it's like not a typical like bubbly romance. It's not something I normally write, but I decided to give it a shot. So that's coming out soon. Other than that, like I said, I'm just focused on getting the sequel out. I'm also hoping to get the Drink of Darkness story edited this summer, so that way I can potentially self-publish that at the same time as the sequel to The Dark Land, since there are ties between the two stories. That one's already written, it just needs a lot of editing.
Well, we certainly wish you the best of luck with that, and we want to thank you for coming on this episode of New Horror Express, and feel free to come back when the sequel comes out.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was my guest, Daniela, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest edition of New Horror Express. If you like what you heard, the best way you can support the show is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Well, that's all for this time. But if you're looking for more New Horror Express fun, we have plenty of other episodes in our back catalogue, including the most recent edition of our Guilty Pleasures series, where me and a couple of great co-hosts look at the film Cherry Falls that went up just last Thursday. As well as that, be sure to join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!